My favorite thing about Bill Mitchell and When Dating Hurts podcast is the opportunity to share my voice and my story. I think that no matter where you are in listening about someone else's situation or sharing your own, that being within a community of listeners where it's safe to share a voice is invaluable. Thank you, Bill.
The When Dating Hurts podcast continues to grow in popularity. The more who listen, the more who will know the realities of dating and domestic violence. In the meantime, the When Dating Hurts book, in paperback, ebook, and audiobook, is being purchased and read by concerned parents, teachers, victims and survivors, and of course, those who are currently dating. Education leads to empowerment. That way, if a potential abuser is targeting you or someone you care about, you will know how to detect it and how to break free and stay safe. Up next, another survivor story to illustrate how an innocent person can become manipulated and trapped in abusive relationships. The first 4 minutes, which you will hear next, are from the moments just before we started Cynthia's actual interview.
I spent such a long time just feeling I didn't make anything of my life, and I wasn't able to make anything of my tragedy or like find any purpose in the suffering. So I'm starting to finally get to a place just now where I'm coming out of that shame and stuff. So I get really inspired when I encounter people such as yourself, is what I'm trying to say.
I've been very fortunate. I feel like throughout my career, my life, I've always had mentors.
Yeah.
Somebody just seems to always be around who I think, if I could just do what that person does, and if I could just, whatever it is, be as smart as that person, do what they're doing, think like that, those things. So, yeah, so it's, you know, the people that I've interviewed, I've been very fortunate. They're all very well spoken. They tell their stories quite well. Yeah. They are heroic people for what they've been able to get through and do. So
I know. I've listened to a lot of them, almost all of them at this point.
You've run the rack, huh?
Yeah. Amazing stories. Some really tough women.
My admiration for all of them, for every last one of them.
I know.
I've done enough now that it's really taxing my memory at this point, because I'll be driving somewhere and I'll think of another one and some facet of a story. And it's like, oh my God, that's right. You know, she went through that and she did that. But somehow every last one manages to land on her feet and tell her story. Every one of them, through either an email at the end or something they say at the end, say how cathartic it was to tell the story all in one place, one time, because many of them had therapy. Many of them told their story to family members, but they haven't told it from here I was as a young teenager, maybe, all the way to today.
Right.
Then tell it in an hour and a half. And they come away feeling really good. So that's wonderful.
I really got to say, and I don't mean to make you feel uncomfortable by saying this, but I really feel like you're doing God's work. I really do. I feel His hand in this whole thing, and just hearing your story, your book, the interviews that you've had with other people, and how He kind of gave you that right after what happened with your daughter, and you had that feeling like there's something's going to come with this.
I did, from the first night.
You know what I mean? And you had that, and I couldn't help but think when you said that, that was God speaking to you in that moment. You know, I just really feel like His hand is all in this, and you're helping people to heal, and you're also putting so much information out there to young women. I know for myself, I have teenage daughters now, and I worry very much for what they've grown up with, that they might find themselves in similar situations now. So this podcast that you have here, you're disseminating very valuable information. And so really you're accomplishing a lot of goals all in one.
I agree. And you know, if I had sat down with a piece of paper and said, let me come up with something that by doing one thing, I could accomplish 30 or 40 things. I never would have thought of this.
Right.
So I agree that I think these things are offered, let's say, to us by a higher power.
It's really special.
Hey, look, I pray every morning. I pray every evening.
Me too.
And what I do is I pray to be an instrument of God's will, however that sounds.
Yeah.
So it's just like, put me in the game, coach, and let's see what I can do. That's it.
It's really special how that's happening and how that's unfolding.
Yes.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity. That being said,
I'm glad that you're getting so much out of it. I really mean that sincerely. Next, you will hear my interview with Cynthia. You will feel her innocence throughout. She is a trusting soul, and sometimes it gets her into places that are impossible to escape. Cynthia is not perfect. She has made mistakes, haven't we all? And it seems most of her mistakes have cost her dearly. No matter what Cynthia has endured, she has remained positive and has looked for the good in people. This is Cynthia's story, with a long list of hurdles throughout and lessons learned. This story comes with trigger warnings. We're going to be speaking with Cynthia. From her email to me, she said her story is hard to listen to at times and that it's raw, but she said, I've been feeling a push to get this out, and that she's hoping that someone else who has an ugly story like this one somewhere and maybe is too ashamed to say or talk about it might hear her story, and maybe it would bring them some comfort. And maybe for others, it will caution them to consider carefully what the cost of staying in an unhealthy relationship too long, what that will cost. So welcome, Cynthia, to the When Dating Hurts podcast. So good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Very good. I was thinking about how to approach this. And what I usually do is I ask people to kind of go back as far as makes sense with your story and give us a sense of what growing up looked like. Mom and dad are there, brothers and sisters. So what did growing up look like for you in the early years?
Right. So growing up was awesome. I mean, we were lower to middle class, you know, but we were happy. Like, we didn't have a lot, but we had each other kind of deal. So my parents are still married to this day. My dad had a substance abuse issue, but he overdosed when I was 2 years old. But my mom loved him through it. And he's been sober ever since. I don't remember any of that, but my brother and my sister do. So that was the only hiccup we ever had in my child rearing years. So, and I don't remember any of it. So to me, it was bliss. Just playing kickball in the street with the kids on the block, you know what I mean? Like that kind of thing. Staying out till dark, not coming in until dinner time. It was the bee's knees. The trouble for me, it didn't really start until I guess I had, well, I don't even know if you could call it your first relationship. So my best friend, when I was in, it wasn't eighth grade, it was ninth grade, my best friend, I slept over her house a lot, and she had this, I don't even know what you would call him, her sister's husband. Mm-hmm. He had a brother who lived in the house, and this brother, he was a 27-year-old man. He was just grooming me over the course of some weeks, you know. He would just make sexual comments, make me feel special, you know, that kind of thing. And eventually he would expose himself. And I didn't know anything about anything. I never even had a boyfriend. I never had any kind of physical anything. I think I was only 15 years old. And it was through this friend and at this same house with this same person that I experienced marijuana for the first time, cigarettes. And then this guy took my virginity. And 27-year-old man. All of this happened in secret without my friend even knowing. When she would fall asleep, I would get like little taps on the wall. And that would be like code for me to come downstairs. All of this, all like, you know what I mean? Like these men are experts in what they do. All of this like little secret communication. He would have my phone number and we would have these conversations at home when I wasn't with her. And this relationship was built over a period of weeks. And I really truly felt I was special. come to find out after the virginity was taken and everything else, and I'm thinking in my 15-year-old naive brain that this is okay, even though part of me knew it wasn't, but I'm still keeping the secret, like, this is okay. It's not okay. I found out he's doing the same thing to my best friend.
Oh.
She tells me, she confides in me. She's like, this is happening. And I'm like, now I feel like I can't tell her it's happening to me too. And so, I don't know what to do. So I take this information. I'm freaking out inside. And I decide, as I've seen my mother do so many times before when she's dealing with an emotional conflict, I'm going to go take a walk. I'm going to just go take a walk and clear my head. The only problem was it was 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh.
When I found this information out, because it's summertime, we're off school, summer, you know, she had called me and told me she was freaking out. I guess they had had some kind of argument or something. And she's like, I really need to tell you something. So I'm going to go for a walk 2 o'clock in the morning to clear my head, because the guy I lost my virginity to is also having the same relationship with my best friend. This is my 15-year-old logic. I know nothing of the world. I walk out the door. I feel like I should just turn around and go back inside. I should just go back in the house.
You felt some sense of danger, you mean?
Yeah, I felt this strong, almost like a voice in my head, just go back in the house. I even turned around and looked at the house. And I was like, I'm too upset. I need to go for a walk. I'm just too upset. I don't want to be in the house. I'm disgusted. I feel like I'm just exploding inside. You know what I mean? Sure. And I don't see, like, what is the danger of going for a walk? If I had known then what I know now, you know? And so I didn't realize at the time that was like something obviously telling me to stay home, stay home. So I go for a walk in my hometown, not realizing that violence can happen to you literally anywhere.
Sure, can.
And so I walk across the bridge. It's like the Schuylkill River Bridge from Montclair into Phoenixville. And there's this little bus stop. And I sit down at a bench. I'm still thinking I'm totally fine. I'm totally okay. It's Phoenixville. I sit down and this car, it just drives by. And I'm not even paying attention to the car, except for the fact that I noticed it was driving kind of slow. And then it pulled into the parking lot behind me. And then the guy got out and then he tried to talk to me. He's like, hey, you know, do you want to hang out or whatever? And I'm like, no, no, I don't. I'm just sitting here, you know, just sitting here and just minding my business. He's like, okay. And so he's with this other guy or whatever, this shorter guy. And they start walking away, you know, and I'm like, okay, well, they obviously pose no threat. I should back up a little bit to say, you know, they offered me substances, marijuana and alcohol. Now, this is a girl who is very sad, very naive, very foolish, I will say. Mm-hmm. And so they walked away. They offered me the stuff. I said, no, thanks. I don't really want to do that. And so in my mind, I thought, well, they walked away. That must mean they're not going to snatch me. And they must not have nefarious ill will toward me, or they wouldn't just walk away. I was like, hey, wait up, wait up. And so I went after him. And I was like, I will take a little bit of that drink. I will. Now, Bill, I do come from a family of addicts, so the genetic makeup is there. You have to keep that in mind about me. I am not a perfect person. I'm not a saint. So I have battled my demons. And so I will just say that up front. I'm going to be a very brutally honest person. And as a result of that very, very bad decision, something very, very bad happened to me that night.
They really took that as a green light, didn't they?
I gave it to him, though. I gave him the green light, unfortunately, Bill. Unfortunately, I did. What ended up happening after that was we went for like a little bitty walk around Phoenixville. He wanted to go to a corner store, essentially, to get like some cigarettes or some such. a police officer actually had seen us, thought it looked very suspicious that a man of that stature was walking with what appeared to be a very little girl, but they decided not to pull him over. I don't know why.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get $6,000 cash, give us each $3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Now, when you say his stature, I think with some other information you gave me, this guy's maybe 6'2 and 270 yeah. pounds.
Yeah.
He's a big guy. I mean, he's like football player size.
He's 270 pounds. That might be accurate. He just feels so much bigger than that in my memory. Could be accurate. Yeah, he literally looks like a linebacker, like a really, 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 really big man. And so it must have looked very bizarre to that police officer seeing us walking hand in hand, because he was holding my hand, literally. But in any case, we walked back towards this one particular street, and I don't remember exactly what I even thought. I'm not sure why I didn't have more alarm bells going off in my head when I try to look back in time on this. Like, I think that's just another way of trying to shame myself in this moment. I don't know. I can't figure out why I didn't have more alarm bells. When I retell this story, I'm blown away. Even a toddler would think there was something wrong with that. I don't know, but whatever. The point is, we start walking back to where the incident actually took place. I guess he decided he was going to get down to business. So we sit down on this one particular stoop, and he proceeds to roll his little blunt. And the one guy, there's like this little, I'm sitting on a step, and there was like this little scaffolding right here. I guess they were painting a wall or something. I'm not sure. And so he goes over here with this little friend, and I guess they're having a discussion, like whether or not the friend wants to stay or leave. Mm-hmm. I can sense in my spirit that something bad's going to happen. And I'm starting to weigh out my options. And, you know, I notice that the behind me, it's like an enclosed parking lot. So I can't run behind me. And then I can't go to my left because both of them are standing there. And if I go run to my right, I don't know where exactly I am. Do I just keep going straight? If I run, will I be able to run fast enough? How fast can he run? Will he catch me? And I'm starting to weigh all these things in my head. Just as I'm thinking these things, he comes right back. The little guy's walking away. And I'm like, oh, no. He just kind of looks at me. And he's like, come on, I'm going to take you home. And so I stood up and I was like, I just looked at him point blank and I was like, are you going to rape me? And he's like, nah, I don't get down with that. I was like, oh, okay. So, you know, he's walking me down the road a little bit, and it's like this back steps of a church is where it happened, which caused a lot of problems between me and God for a while, even though it wasn't God's fault. And I'm starting to feel this in my body now while I'm telling it. I apologize if I get quivers in my voice.
Of course. It's okay.
So we get to the steps and he's like, shh, my mom's sleeping. I need you to be quiet. I don't want to wake her up. So I don't know if he just thought I was like really stoned or something. I wasn't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or if this was just all, I heard somebody talk recently about psychopaths and sociopaths, and that sometimes they'll do stuff like this just as a, pardon my French, but just as a mind fuck, like because they get off on it. I spent years trying to figure out why he was being so weird. And when I heard that lady say that, I was like, so when I finish the story, maybe you'll concur. Maybe you'll concur. So anyway, he goes, I need you to be quiet. My mom's sleeping. He was just pretending. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. Yeah. So we're on the step. He has me sit down on the step. He wants me to, you know, perform like oral, and I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do it. I didn't do it. So I turn my head this way, and he just starts pummeling on my face. And I didn't even have any time to react. So it just flew backwards. I don't think I saw anything but like three flashes of light.
But he's punching you in the head, in the face?
Oh, yeah. He's punching me. It's like as hard as you could imagine ever getting hit by anything. Like it just felt like I was, all I remember is like three bright white flashes, and then everything just went black. And I flew back on the back of the steps. And when my eyes opened, I mean, I've never seen anything like this. Blood was spraying out of my, it was like a faucet spraying out of my face. I mean, nobody probably wants to hear that, but it's something that just is so poignant, burned into my brain. And I didn't know that could even happen. Mm-hmm. I think that freaked him out a little bit too. He just made me like stand up really quick and turn around. That whole thing happened. And then ironically, and thank goodness, it gives me a sense of satisfaction to this day, he could not finish that activity. And I don't know. Something weird happened in the midst of it. Something really, there's like an exchange of energy that happens when you're being attacked by someone, a very visceral exchange. You know, you can feel them and they can feel you. And I could feel every ounce of hate in him. I knew he wanted to kill me. I knew it. And so my life flashes before your eyes and you have these thoughts like, my parents are going to have to identify my body. And what is it going to look like? Is he going to leave me here? Is he going to take me somewhere else? And like, is God going to take me? Is God going to accept me as I am? Did I live a good life? Was I a good kid? Was I, you know what I mean? Like you're thinking about all these things in just a flash. And just as I'm thinking these things and feeling these things, and what did I do today? And why did I make that choice? And all these things, like he just, everything changed in an instant. It was so weird. It's like he went limp. He went limp. He made me turn around and stand up. And he said I was wearing a tank top and like a shirt on the outside. I don't know how to describe it. Like a button-up shirt that was open with the tank top underneath. He had me take the shirt on the outside off and put it on my face. He's like, you are bleeding a lot. Put this on your face and put your head back. He's like being a nurse.
That's strange. That's really weird.
It was. Here's where the mind F comes into play. You know what I mean? So he's like, put your head back. And this still just makes me feel really weird. I don't know. I don't know if this was like some kind of psychosis or like, I don't know. And so then he's like, if anybody asks, tell them you were jumped by a bunch of girls for your shoes. And then he's like, do you need me to show you where the hospital is? I'll walk you there. And I was like, no, it's okay. I grew up here. And he's like, well, do you ever want to hang out again? I can give you my number. My name's Tracy.
That is so strange.
I was like, no, that's okay.
Let's start a nice, healthy relationship now that I've beaten you horribly.
I was like, that's okay. Let's do this again sometime. So, yeah.
Yeah, let's hang out because this... Yeah, can't get enough of you.
It was so bizarre. It really was. It was just the weirdest thing. And I spent years and years and years like, what was that? What was that? And then, so then when I heard that lady, like some of these people just really get off on screwing with people's heads as part of it, you know?
Yeah, he was good at that.
And that's the only thing I can think. So basically we walked through this little path, continuing on through the back of this church. And he went one way and I went the other. And I'm still walking, mind you, with this shirt on my face, still bleeding. And I can't see out of both of my eyes. I got like one slits I can see out of. I'm like, you know, and my hair's matted with blood. I mean, I look like a real freak show. And it's 4 o'clock in the morning at this point. The first car I see, it slowed down because it could tell that something was a problem. I mean, it was all down the front of me. And then I pulled my shirt down as if to say, help me, please. The car just sped off, you know, like, and honestly, like, I remember in that moment feeling really angry about that. I don't know. I'm still kind of angry about it. A little bit also, it had to be really scary to see that. It did. I don't know. If it were me, I wouldn't do that. But for the average Joe, most people are really scared and they don't know what to do in traumatic situations. I think that was a really shitty thing to do, but I'm not entirely surprised by human nature, just knowing what it is and how frail most of us really are.
Somebody can look at it in an instant and say, there's a bunch of trouble. And on the other hand, if I just hit the gas pedal, I just go right back to my life the way it was. So do I want a bunch of trouble with her? Because I don't know how she got like that.
And whatever caused that trouble might be right behind her.
That's true too. Yes.
Yeah. You know.
Did he actually rape you though?
He did. And like both ways.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did they ever catch him?
Yeah, right away. Right away.
How did that happen?
Because they knew exactly who he was. He's a violent offender.
Had he been in and out of prison before this or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, big time. So he's a serial domestic abuser and a drug dealer. He's never had any prior sex offenses, though. So I wouldn't be surprised if he had offended, just never been convicted.
Did you have to go and testify or go into a courtroom and everything like this?
Yes. Yes. It was agonizing. And he ended up spending 20 years in prison. The arraignment hearing, my mom actually, I think, tried to get a law passed so that victims of violent crime didn't have to be forced to testify in front of their offender.
Right.
Because of how traumatic it was. I sobbed. I mean, I became almost feral before I had to go in there. It was it was almost as bad as having it happen the first time. Just the sound of the shackles coming down the hallway. It was awful. It was awful. Mm. So he ended up pleading guilty to 8 to 16 years. It was a deal. They didn't think I would be able to do trial because of how I was sleeping on my parents' floor for 6 months. So I wasn't doing very well.
It's very understandable. God bless you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh. So he pled guilty and then he ended up violating the terms of his release. So he went back in and served more additional time.
Is he out at this point, you think? Is he back?
He's out and he lives. You're going to love this. He lives about 20 minutes away from me. So that makes me feel really good. That makes me feel really super good. I just found that out the other day because Megan's Law updates me every time he moves. So
that chapter is one heck of a chapter in your story.
It's a bad one. It's a bad one. And so that kind of brings us to the abusive relationship thing. I learned a really interesting thing from Dr. Drew, actually. It was just a theory he kind of floated. I don't think it's like a theory he floated out there. I think it's like a common, you know, term in psychology, traumatic reenactment. That's where I first came across it. And it's this thing we do where we're attracted to what's familiar. And when pain becomes what's familiar to us, our subconscious will kind of reach out to the same things in other people, whether we realize it or not. We'll find ourselves being drawn to partners and mates that are familiar, even in ways that we don't physically identify. It's just, we're just being drawn to that. And so what I didn't even realize until I'm putting the pieces together years later, I mean, my ex-husband checks all the boxes. He is a serial sex sadist and has been throughout the history of our marriage. He looks almost exactly like my sex offender, except he's white instead of black. It was just like, did I feel like I needed to be punished? Was I trying to work out that trauma? Was I trying to, like, I don't know what I was trying to sort out, but that's kind of where it started.
Where did you meet this person and how did you feel when you first met this person?
High school. So this was, I guess, probably a year and a half after what happened to me. I was like 17-ish, 17 and a half, maybe, yeah, almost 18. So I hadn't quite graduated, but it was like towards the end of senior year. And I met him through a friend of mine, but we realized that we had already met each other in sixth grade before he had moved away and then came back to the same area. So we knew each other from years prior, and then I guess met each other again. So it kind of felt familiar for that reason too. Like, hey, I know you.
Did he go to the same high school with you?
Well, no, it was a different high school, but he had once gone to my school district. Yeah. So we met each other through a mutual friend. Like when you're in high school, sometimes you mingle with different high schools, you know.
The kind of crisscross, yes.
Yeah, exactly. So it was like that. It was like that. So we started dating pretty much right away. I'll be honest, he was a bad boy. He was the guy you went to, you know, if you ever needed some marijuana. So, you know, everybody knew my ex. I wanted to be around him too because he had some status and he was fun to be around. So I was trying to feel happy. I didn't feel happy and I just wanted some happy times. So my friend would take me over there. We would just go out and ride around on the town, you know, and have a good time. That's how it started. Mm-hmm. It started like that and went to we're spending time with each other 24/7, like overnight. I mean, I pretty much went from I live with my parents to I live with him overnight. Mm-hmm. That's like how it went.
Somehow you must have felt some version of security being around him.
Yeah, I guess so. He was big and burly, and I felt like nobody's really going to mess with me, you know, when I'm with him, and everybody knows who he is, and nobody's going to mess with him either. So I did feel kind of safe and protected when I was with him.
Besides having access to fun, you know, whatever version of wild fun you were having, was there anything about him that was attractive to you? In himself, his styling or whatever his act was?
Yeah, I was physically attracted to him.
Okay.
He checked all the boxes as far as I was concerned. Physically attractive. He had kind of brooding eyes. He looked, just kind of had that dangerous look, though, to be honest with you. I think that's what it is. And even still to this day, I struggle with this, which is why I'm still single, honestly. I find myself being drawn to a man who's got a dangerous look in his eyes. So I think that's partly what it was. Honestly, and that's not a good thing to be attracted to.
No, I wouldn't think it was.
That's my trauma. Like, so I can recognize that now. I couldn't recognize that then.
I've talked with a number of people recently who, upon reflection, look back on somebody like this guy and they say, you know, it really got bad at times, but on the other hand, I really kind of was attracted to the whole drama of the 24/7 with that person. You know, I didn't like all of it, but it was, there was a lot of energy, there was a lot of drama. And on the other hand, to go and spend time with somebody who's, quote, normal, end quote, somebody who's just very stable and sensitive, can be rather boring. So over here's all the highs and lows, very high, very low. And over here is flatline. Do you think that you maybe felt some of that?
That's so interesting you say that. That is so interesting you say that. Because like on one hand, when you're in it, you're so exhausted by it. You're so exhausted by it. And you just honestly, sometimes you feel like you'd rather die than spend another day in it. But at the same time, when I tried to have a normal relationship one time, I was so bored. I really was. And I feel so bad because I hurt this guy's apart because he really cared about me. And I had to let him go. I had to say, listen, it's just not working out for me. And he was like, why? I couldn't really give him a good reason. I was like, listen, it's not because I don't think you're attractive. It's not because of anything other than the fact that just nothing. Like, how do you tell somebody I'm bored? Like, how do you tell them that, you know?
This is not my opinion. This is what I picked up in talking with so many people. But I think some people kind of become terminally nice. It's just, you're just so nice, but there's nothing to work with.
Bill, you get addicted to the conflict. Or it's like I was saying at the beginning, when pain becomes all that's familiar to you, you don't know how to be comfortable with anything else. You don't know how to be comfortable with anything other than chaos.
Yes, good way to put it.
If that's all you've ever had. So when things get too quiet, sometimes I'm like, what's coming down the pike? Like, what's going to happen tomorrow? You know, like, if
it's got to be an explosion coming soon, right?
Yeah. So, yeah.
Thinking back to your notes, this guy was telling you things like he loved you, but you had only been around him a couple weeks.
Yeah. He told me he loved me for the first time after 2 weeks.
How did you feel when you heard that? I mean, did you think that's great, or did you think, wow, this is kind of early?
No, I thought it was weird. I did not like that. At the same time, I set it back because I felt like it would be weird not to. I was young, and again, I was foolish. You know, like, you are concerned more with people's feelings than you are when you get older, when you're younger. You don't want to hurt people's feelings by being honest and holding boundaries and saying things like, that's not really okay, because you can't love somebody after 2 weeks. So what I did was I was people pleasing instead. And I just said, oh, I love you too. Even though that wasn't accurate at all. So that's how that went. Yeah.
Didn't want to let him down, I guess.
Right. And he would say things, you know, but he would make, I don't know that he would say things like, oh, you're so beautiful, or you're so awesome. He would say things like, you know, sexually derogatory things like, you have the greatest butt in the world, or this is what I want to do to you. And for some reason, I would just accept that. And I don't know. I don't know why I accepted that. I can only say that it just come from a place where I was very sexually traumatized, and I was allowing a lot of things in my life at that time. And so I wasn't particularly love bombed at that time. Not that I can truly remember. Maybe I was, but I don't have the greatest recollection.
When you're 17, 18 years old, you're really young. I mean, at the time you may not think you're young, but you are young.
Yeah.
So you don't have a lot of experience. You don't have a lot of coping skills,
right,
which come only through experience, because you have to have things happen. And then you realize, wow, I misinterpreted that.
Right.
Next time I won't let that happen. But I think one of the things that happens, what I'm reading into what you're telling me, is that from a self-esteem standpoint, you were allowing a lot of things to happen around you that now you look back and it's like, what was I thinking? Why did I ever let that happen? Low self-esteem is a problem, because right, when that happens, you leave all the doors open and anything can come in.
Right. Yeah. And that is mm-hmm. what mm-hmm. happened. Yeah. And so I'm not saying he didn't love bomb at all, because he did. You know, he would pick me up all the time and he would take me to school. He would buy me little things, you know, snacks, coffees. He would try to make me feel special, give me flowers and things along those lines. I just don't remember him giving me lots of words of affirmation or things like that. You know what I mean? He wasn't like Mr. Poetry or anything along those lines. So he would be one to just tell me how glorious he thought my buns were constantly, or what he wanted to do with my body, because I was nothing more than a mere possession.
I'm sorry about that. Very sorry about that.
That's okay. That's okay. I did get pregnant pretty quickly into the relationship, just because we were engaging in a lot of just teenage behavior with minimal parental supervision. And neither one of us was really acting from a responsible place. So I did get pregnant. And this was let's see, this was pretty much right after my high school graduation. So I guess we weren't really teenagers anymore, but we still kind of were, in my opinion. I mean, I'm a parent. I would still call my 18-year-old a teenager because, you know, they think they're grown, but they're not. In any case, I did get pregnant. And that's really when I think things changed between us. And I hear a lot of other women in domestic violence situations say the same thing, because this, the attention is no longer on him at that point.
Having a baby brings people together or pushes them apart.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as the way it used to be.
Right. You know, at first he was very excited. I remember his mom said, "Who's the father?" Yeah, she did. She said, "Who's the father?" Because she could not comprehend the fact that her son, you know, did that.
So you're saying she finds out that you're pregnant and her first thought is it must have been someone else, not her son?
Correct.
Interesting.
Yeah, and at that time you have to understand that I was living with him. We both walked in the door together and he goes, "Mom, you know, she's having a baby, she's pregnant, you know," and she's like, literally to both of us, "Who's the father?"
I don't know. Anybody in this room the father?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right. Let me
gotta be somebody.
These are the people, you know, these are the people. But you know, it's so funny because I'm actually really close with her still.
Oh, good.
So
that's good.
She's an interesting person. That was funny, that but is. Also not at the time it wasn't, but I can laugh about it now.
How did you feel about being pregnant? Were you kind of like, yikes, this came early, I'm panicking, or wow, great?
It was probably something that saved me.
Oh.
Because I was being really reckless and stupid, making really dumb decisions, coming from a place of pain, and I was struggling big time with PTSD. I still didn't even really know what PTSD was. I had been to a psychiatrist and she told me, she said, "Well, you have a lot of traits of autism, but also those overlap with PTSD. So I don't really think that a test, an autism screening would be beneficial at this time." So she said, "In my opinion, I know for sure that you have PTSD, and PTSD is forever. You can't get rid of that." And in my head, that was all I heard. That's all I heard was, "You're damaged goods and you have PTSD now forever." But nobody really told me what that was or what that was going to entail. And in my little teenage brain, I didn't do my due diligence. I didn't like read books about it. I mean, I did later and now I know a lot about it. But back then, I didn't know. I saw stuff in my brain all the time. I had nightmares all the time. So I wanted to, like, not see that stuff.
This concludes Cynthia's story, part one of two parts. And look for part two on the When Dating Hurts podcast. The When Dating Hurts podcast is always looking for survivor stories. Survivors give us powerfully descriptive ways to see and feel the intense horror that is domestic violence. From the warning signs they either missed or ignored, to the days of suffering, emotional and physical abuse, but still staying in these relationships. Survivors explain the hidden world we want our listeners to fully understand and steer clear of. If there is a story you want us to hear, contact me at BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. That's Bill Mitchell at WhenDatingHurts.com. Hi, it's Bill Mitchell. I'm proud to say the When Dating Hurts podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To learn more about Evergreen Podcasts or to check out other shows on the Evergreen Network, just visit EvergreenPodcasts.com.